So our passage this morning is Hebrews chapter 9, verses 15 to 28. And this passage then has a few fairly long and intimidating phrases within it. But actually the most important phrase within this passage is very short and to the point. It's just three words, each of those words containing one syllable. You'll find it in verse 26, and it's this: once for all. Once for all. The phrase is being used there by the writer to describe Jesus' sacrifice on the cross at Calvary. He's describing that sacrifice of Jesus as once for all. And really then the whole of this passage is simply an unpacking of that little phrase. What does that mean? What does it mean that Jesus' sacrifice was once for all? Well, I want to suggest from our passage this morning that it means at least two things. And first of all then, it means you could live long before it happened without exclusion. It means you could live long before it happened without exclusion. And this is the first paragraph of our passage, verses 15 to 22. So remember then how in verses 12 and 13, our writer has indicated the inadequacy of animal sacrifices, the blood of goats and calves and bulls. And he has said then that these animal sacrifices, they are very limited in what they can achieve. And of course, he has described the blood of Christ, by contrast, as wonderfully adequate. It achieves everything which the blood of animals could not achieve. And that's great, that's fantastic. But it raises this question: what about those who lived their lives before Jesus had ever been sacrificed on the cross at Calvary? Those who lived their lives when the only type of blood available to them was animal blood. What about them? Well, we've noticed a few times as we've gone through Hebrews that our writer often treats things in the opposite way round from how you'd expect him to treat them. And he does that here because he first of all answers that question. What about those people who live the other side of the cross of Calvary? He answers that in verse 15, and we'll come to that in a moment. But in verses 16 to 22, having answered the question already, he then actually underlines just what an interesting question it is by showing how pervasive animal sacrifices were in that Old Testament period. You see, it wasn't just a matter of the Day of Atonement. So far, in what he said about animal sacrifices, he's related all that to that annual Day of Atonement that had such a prominent place within Israel's calendar. The way in which the high priest on that day would enter into the most holy place and there in that sacred room would sprinkle the blood. In these verses, however, he mentions another context in which animal sacrifices also figured prominently, not now the annual Day of Atonement, but now the inauguration, the opening ceremony, if you like, of that old covenant at Mount Sinai. And follow this with me then. First of all, in verses 16 and 17, he simply speaks in general terms about covenants between God and man. And as I said earlier in the service, I think covenant is the best reading in those two verses. And what he says, and I guess this is why it's tempting to change it from covenant to will, what he says is really rather odd. He says in verse 16, where a covenant is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. Now, the one who made it, then that's referring to the human party in this covenant between God and man. And in the second half of verse 17, he reiterates it. He says, it is not in force, this covenant, it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. But it's in the first part of verse 17 that he's actually most explicit and most gruesome, although this is obscured in our translation, because here in the ESV it says, for a covenant takes effect only at death. Really what he says there is, a covenant takes effect only on the basis of the dead bodies. Only on the basis of the corpses. That's what that phrase literally says. And so our writer is saying then that when God and man come together in covenant, in order for that covenant to take effect, in order for it to become operative, in order for it to be officially inaugurated, the human party in the covenant must die. Imagine a school setting, and there's a child then in the school, and this child is notorious for being the school's naughtiest child. And then in this same school, there's a teacher, and this teacher is renowned for being the strictest teacher in the school. And for the first time, their paths are going to cross. There's going to be a lesson where the class is that naughtiest child's class and the teacher is that strictest teacher. And you can imagine then an observer, someone who knows the school, perhaps another teacher or another pupil, you can imagine an observer who knows the situation looking ahead at that prospect and saying something like this, well, the teacher may just as well give that child a detention before the lesson even begins. I mean, it's just so inevitable that from the very first moments of the lesson, that child's naughtiness is going to clash with that teacher's strictness, that there might as well just be a detention from the very start. And that's kind of the idea that we have here in verses 16 and 17. You see, in a covenant between God and man, you have this meeting of such holiness on the one hand, God, and such sinfulness on the other hand, man, that inevitably from the very first moments of the relationship, God's judgment is going to be aroused. And so like that detention being issued with the very ringing of the bell at the start of the lesson, so the death of the human party was required with the very inauguration of the covenant relationship itself. But of course it leads to a rather absurd situation then, doesn't it? Because how is this covenant relationship going to work if one party is dead from the very outset? Well, let's continue in our passage, and we come to verse 18. And in verse 18 then, our writer moves on from the general, from talking about covenants between God and man generally, a general principle, to specifically the covenant of Sinai. The first covenant, that's the Sinai covenant. And he says then in verse 18 that this principle I've just been talking about, it applied to this covenant then. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. So there at Sinai, there was this shedding of blood. The death of the human party was required from the very point of inauguration. Except that then you come to verse 19, and there's a twist. Verse 19, for when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of the Israelites with water and scarlet wool. No, doesn't say that, does it? He took the blood of calves and goats. And this then is how these covenants between God and man could work. Yes, the blood of the human party was actually required, strictly speaking, there at the very point of inauguration, but the blood of animals was shed in lieu of the blood of the human party. And at Sinai then, in this specific example, all this ritual blood sprinkling that had to take place for the covenant to formally get underway, the sprinkling of book and people, verse 19, the sprinkling of tent and vessels, verse 21, it was all done with the blood of calves and goats rather than with the blood of the Israelites themselves. But now you see, we're ready to return to that basic question with which I began then. The blood of calves and goats, we're saying, had this central, pervasive role in that Old Testament period. Doesn't matter whether you look at the annual Day of Atonement, doesn't matter whether you look at the original opening ceremony of the covenant, doesn't matter where you look. The blood of animals had this central, pervasive role, and yet the blood of animals was inherently deficient and unsatisfactory. So where then does that leave the people who lived in that context? And you can say, well, most of those Old Testament Israelites, they were stubborn, hard-hearted, rebellious folk anyway. It doesn't matter what blood was shed, it doesn't really apply to them. And that may be true, but of course, not all of them were. And we're told then in verse 15, aren't we, that there were people in that context who were called. And you know the New Testament significance of that word called. It was there in our opening text this morning in Romans 8. It's that powerful, effective, converting call of God. There were people in that Old Testament period who were called, and were called, the writer says, to receive the promised eternal inheritance. So there were these people then who were called by God to the eternal inheritance, and yet they were forced to live their lives within a system dominated by ineffective animal sacrifices. Sacrifices which taught the principle that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins, verse 22. But sacrifices which couldn't actually themselves secure a little bit of forgiveness even, and couldn't possibly deliver that promised eternal inheritance. So should we then simply shake our heads sadly this morning as we think of all those called people in the Old Testament period? Are we dealing here with a category of people who were called by God, but who won't experience that eternal rest in the world to come because there was no proper blood available to them? I mean, we love to go to Romans 8, don't we? That text with which we began. Those God predestined, he also called, and those he called, he also justified, and those he justified, he also glorified. And we love to stress that this is an unbreakable chain, and you can't just experience some parts of it and not the other parts of it. Well, should we make an exception when it comes to those who lived before Christ? Were some of them called, really called, but they miss out on final glorification? Well, now we're ready to go to our writer's answer, there in the opening verse of our passage, in verse 15. And this is his answer, that Jesus is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. How? Since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. What's he talking about? What's this death? This isn't the death of any animal now. This is the death of Jesus himself. Jesus' death. You see what he's saying then? He's saying, no, those called men and women of the Old Testament period, they had nothing within their own system which could deal with their sins and could deliver that promised eternal inheritance. They could look at their annual Day of Atonement, and that featured sacrifices. And they could look back at the inauguration of the covenant at Sinai, and that featured sacrifices. But these were all just deficient animal sacrifices. But one day, a proper sacrifice was going to take place. A sacrifice that they only had vague and faint ideas about as they reflected on the promises and types at their disposal. But with their limited information, they nonetheless looked forward to that sacrifice. And as they looked forward to that sacrifice, amazingly, its benefits were conferred on them. Backwards. They were backdated, as it were, retrospectively. the benefits of Christ's sacrifice, they were propelled back into the lives of men and women and boys and girls called by God, living before the sacrifice had actually taken place. So that our writer says, sins committed under the first covenant, during that chronological period, they were nonetheless forgiven through the blood of the new covenant, the blood of Jesus Christ. Now, I guess this whole question then, what was the situation of those people who lived before Christ's sacrifice? I guess it's a question which resonated much more for these first readers of Hebrews than it does for us this morning. I mean, it was all much more recent for them. And when it came to heroes, these first readers of Hebrews, they didn't have Augustine or Luther or Calvin or Whitfield or Spurgeon to select from when it came to heroes. No, their heroes would predominantly have been the saints of the Old Testament period. And so for them then, this question would have meant an awful lot. Well, what about those people? Were they okay? Were their sins dealt with? Will they be there in that eternal inheritance? So the question meant a lot for them, but perhaps for us this morning, it should simply remind us what a brilliant thing the sacrifice of Jesus Christ is. I mean, you think of medicine, and we have at our disposal then in 2017 all these drugs and all these surgical procedures that are so sophisticated and so advanced. And we think sometimes, don't we, if only they'd had them in former times, then so many premature deaths could have been prevented. And we perhaps think how many premature deaths today could be prevented if only we had now the drugs and surgical procedures that future generations will have. It's not like that when it comes to the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. It's not like the discovery of penicillin. You aren't lucky or unlucky depending on this chronological lottery, depending on whether you live before it or after it. No, it's once for all, our writer says. It stretches back to those who predated it and confers its benefits on them. There's no exclusion because of where you come in history. It's not to say, and we've stressed this in recent weeks, it's not to say that we don't have greater privileges than them. Of course we do. We know with such clarity about the sacrifice of Jesus. It's better to be living now than then, certainly. But you're not excluded from the benefits of Christ's sacrifice because you're King David 1,000 years before it happened, or you're Hezekiah, or whoever you want to pick out. It's brilliant, isn't it? All these people from that Old Testament period saved. And of course, we're talking about believers here, those who did trust in that sacrifice to come that they had these faint ideas about. But all these believers in that Old Testament period, saved through a sacrifice that hadn't yet happened, through blood which hadn't yet flowed, through a Saviour who hadn't yet stepped onto the stage of history. We sing, don't we, of the power of the cross and how powerful it is to save people like us, whom you would think morally are beyond its reach. We're so lost in sin. And I'm saying here's another dimension to the power of the cross. Its power to save people whom you would think chronologically are beyond its reach. They're so lost in antiquity. What a brilliant thing is the once for all sacrifice of Jesus. We sang in our second hymn this morning about the depths of wisdom revealed, the depths of wisdom which shine in the cross of Christ. And certainly that's true, isn't it? How it points us to the wisdom of our God. The way in which you could live long before it happened without exclusion. But then secondly, We're asking, what does this phrase once for all mean? Secondly, it means you can live long after it happened without repetition. It means you can live long after it happened without repetition. And this is verses 23 to 28, the second paragraph of our passage. So we've just said then that for one paragraph, our writer kind of has a different Old Testament point in mind. He has this covenant inauguration ceremony at Sinai in mind. He's been thinking of the Day of Atonement before that in chapter 9, but in verses 15 to 22, he's thinking particularly of Sinai and the inauguration of the covenant there. But now in this next paragraph, he reverts again to the Day of Atonement, and that's clearly prominent in his thinking once more. So if you're a teacher, or if for that matter you're a pupil, the end of term this past Friday, it didn't take you by surprise, I'm sure. You've been on countdown to it for weeks. And that countdown, of course, it's not just a matter of mere mental knowledge. Okay, so it's such and such a date today, that means it's so many weeks and so many days until we break up. But it's a matter of instinct, I'm sure. You felt it in your bones. It's that time. It's time for the holidays to begin. And if you were a first century Jew then, your internal body clock, if you like, was similarly oriented, not of course toward the summer holidays, but toward the annual Day of Atonement. And perhaps then 10 months had gone by since the last Day of Atonement. 11 months had gone by. 11.5 months had gone by, and everything would be screaming out within you, another act of atonement is required. I can't go on much longer in the strength of that last one that is now such a distant memory. That was what it was like if you were a first century Jew. And these first readers of Hebrews then were first century Jews, albeit first century Jews who had been converted to Jesus Christ. And it would have been no easy thing then for them to kind of just switch off those deep-seated instincts. So yes, Jesus had made this sacrifice for their sins at Calvary, but that was ages ago now. That was just a distant memory. How long could they go on in the strength of that? It would have been tempting for them to think in those terms, because that is how they had always thought. And that's why then in this paragraph, our writer again contrasts Calvary with the annual Jewish Day of Atonement, but not now so much in terms of Jesus' blood versus animal blood, although that is hinted. Not now so much in terms of securing access into the true holy places versus securing access only into an earthly copy, although that's definitely mentioned. But now he contrasts the two mainly in these terms: a one-off event versus an endlessly repeated ritual. The sacrifice of Calvary, a one-off event, as opposed to the ongoing, interminable ritual of the annual Day of Atonement. And so you see, don't you, that that's emphatic here, that he just keeps coming back to it. Verse 25 of Christ, nor was it to offer himself repeatedly. Verse 26, then he would have had to suffer repeatedly. Again, verse 26, he has appeared once for all, our phrase that we're focusing on. Verse 28, he has been offered once. He will appear a second time not to deal with sin. And so you see this emphasis here on Christ's Calvary sacrifice not requiring, not having any repetition. And he's saying then to these readers of his, look, it doesn't matter how long ago now Jesus' sacrifice was. It doesn't matter how much of a distant memory it may be. It doesn't matter how much water has gone under the bridge since that Easter weekend when Christ went through all of that for us. We can go our whole lives on the strength of it. And in fact, the church of God can go until the very end of time on the strength of it. It's once for all. There's no repetition. And just then, as we close, I want you to notice that regarding this whole idea then, this whole idea of Jesus' sacrifice being repeated, our writer says three things. First of all, he says it's unnecessary. It's unnecessary. The repetition of Jesus' sacrifice is unnecessary. Why is it unnecessary? That great phrase, verse 26. Again, it's just three short words. He appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin. Put away sin. That's a staggering claim, isn't it? Imagine in a few years' time there's a G20 summit and you have all these leaders from the world nations, and they come together and they spend several days then having their meetings and their discussions, and they then have a press conference at the end, and they're all sitting there looking unusually happy and pleased with themselves, and then up steps Mrs. Merkel or Mr. Trump or Mr. Putin or someone and says, we've got good news for you all. We've solved the problem of Islamic terrorism. And in fact, we've solved the problem of the migrant crisis. And in fact, while we're at it, we've solved the problem of greenhouse gases. And in fact, we've also solved the problem of North Korea. It's now going to be a peaceful, cooperative state. I mean, it would stretch our credulity a little bit, wouldn't it? We'd be somewhat dubious. Even if they're just making one of those claims, actually, we would feel that it's a little bit too good to be true. But all those claims and another 100 like them pale into insignificance alongside this claim that Jesus has solved the problem of sin for his people. I mean, that's the great problem, isn't it? Islamic terrorism and the migrant crisis and greenhouse gases and North Korea, they're serious enough perhaps, but none of those problems alienate men and women and boys and girls from God and consign them to everlasting hell. Sin does. And this verse is saying Jesus hasn't simply made some headway with the problem. He hasn't simply put a dent in the problem. He has put sin away. That's why repetition of his sacrifice is unnecessary. Were he to die again, in fact, were he to die again 1,000 times on the cross, sin would not be any more dealt with at the end of that process than it is now, because it's fully dealt with now. I wonder if you're a believer this morning, are you basking in the full glory of that? That a sacrifice performed 2,000 years ago dealt with your sin absolutely, completely, comprehensively. You know what it's like when you have an agitated night's sleep, and in your dreams then there's this problem that's there, and it's just this unresolved problem, and it just seems to kind of linger all night, and the problem's just constantly there, and you don't seem to get anywhere with it. And then morning comes and you wake up, and slowly you realize that actually that problem, it doesn't even exist. It's all fictional. It's all just part of the dream. It's such a liberating discovery, isn't it? And when you and I then, as believers, are troubled by our guilt, and troubled by what God thinks of our guilt, and troubled by what God thinks of us because of our guilt, we need to wake up and realize the problem doesn't even exist. It's all fictional. It's all a bad dream. Because Jesus has put our guilt away completely. God doesn't think anything of our guilt. He doesn't think anything of us because of our guilt. There is no guilt. It's gone. Jesus has dismantled it. He's nullified it. He's deconstructed it. He's removed it from the realm of reality, from the realm of existence, from the realm of being. That's what our author is claiming. This once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus, repetition, is unnecessary. But then secondly, it's unthinkable. The repetition of Jesus' sacrifice, it's unthinkable. Why is it unthinkable? Well, because our writer says in verse 27, it is appointed for man to die once. And Jesus is a man, as chapter 2 has put it so emphatically. Since the children share in flesh and blood, he, that is the Son of God, he himself likewise partook of the same things. And again, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect. Jesus is a man. And as a man then, he has to operate by the same set of rules that all men operate by. And if then you and I cannot live our lives on this earth and then die and then come back again for a second stint and die a second time, if that option isn't available for us, then it's not available for him either. In other words, even if for some strange reason Jesus wanted to repeat his sacrifice, he couldn't possibly repeat his sacrifice. He couldn't die on the cross a second time. It would violate the rules of his human existence. It would be overstepping the boundaries of his humanity. It would be undoing the very incarnation itself. That's what our writer is saying. It's unthinkable. Whatever God has appointed for man must apply to Jesus. Otherwise, he's not truly a man. And if God, therefore, has appointed this for man, you die only once. Then Jesus must die once. His sacrifice cannot be repeated. So it's unnecessary, it's unthinkable, and then thirdly, it's undesirable. It's undesirable, the repetition of Jesus' sacrifice. Why is it undesirable? Well, notice that verse 27 then, it doesn't just say, does it, it is appointed for man to die once. It then adds, and after that comes judgment, which doesn't mean then that the great day of judgment is experienced by each believer as soon as he or she dies. Of course, that's not the case. The great day of judgment will be experienced by all human beings at exactly the same time, namely at the end of history when Jesus Christ returns. But what it does mean is that once you've died, all that awaits is now the day of judgment. There are no more lives on earth that you can have, kind of squeezed in between your death and the day of judgment. You can't come back and live and die again, and then come back and live and die again. It can't happen. So our writer here isn't saying anything about the time scale involved. He isn't saying anything about how long might elapse between death and judgment. He's simply emphasizing the unrepeatableness of a person's earthly life. You only get one shot at it. That's what he's saying. Which is why, by the way, it is of colossal importance that you respond, every one of you, to the Christian gospel while you're still alive on earth. You won't get another chance to respond to it after you've died. The only thing that will await after you've died is that great day of judgment. You know what it's like, some of you perhaps, when you book tickets for some big event, perhaps a musical event or a sporting event or whatever it might be. And the tickets then, they go on sale on a certain date. And these days you have to book them online. And so they go on sale at 9 o'clock on a certain morning. And you have to then get your timing. If you want to book tickets, you have to get your timing absolutely perfect, because within about 45 seconds, all 70,000 tickets will have gone, and so you have to be absolutely spot on with your timing, otherwise they'll all be snapped up. You can't faff around at night when 9 o'clock comes. You can't be distracted when 9 o'clock comes. You've got to be really on the ball to be successful in purchasing the tickets. And it's a striking thought then, that when that event, whatever it is, comes around, everyone who's there enjoying that lengthy and substantial event, they're all there because of what happened during a 45-second period many months earlier. And similarly, everyone who will be there in that world to come, safe and happy in the presence of the triune God, will be there because of what happened during one short life here on earth long, long before. And this morning, you're in the middle of that short life on earth. You're in that 45-second period. That 45-second period in which everything is decided. Your entire eternal future rests on what happens now during this handful of days that you have before your time is up and there's no more opportunity. It all depends on now. You can't faff around. You can't be distracted. You need to resolve this issue now. Are you safe? Have you taken hold of Jesus Christ? Will you be okay on the day of judgment? Once you've died, the case is closed. And it's never reopened. And there's no more opportunities. It needs to be resolved now, before this short blink of an eye life of yours is over. You've this brief window on which will rest your entire eternal destiny. Don't fritter it away. Don't fritter it away by prioritizing your career or your family or your fortune or your hobby or whatever it might be, because those things have no bearing whatsoever on your eternal future. Make sure you've taken hold of Jesus Christ, because it will all come down entirely to that. And you don't know when the window's going to close. You might think it'll still be quite a time off. Perhaps it won't. Perhaps it will be tonight. How do you know it won't be today? Imagine it. Imagine being everlastingly miserable. All because during those crucial years you had on earth, you prioritized the wrong things. There's nothing more tragic than that. And so I'm saying, make sure you take seriously these words of our writer. It is appointed for man to die once, and after that, the only thing that awaits is the judgment. But what I want you to notice here is this. Our writer does something interesting, because he says then, just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, and so he goes on. And so you can see how he's establishing a parallel then here between what is appointed for men generally and what happened to Christ. But if it were an exact parallel then, it would have to say, so Christ, having died once, then awaits judgment. But it doesn't say that. It says, so Christ, yes, having died once, will appear a second time. The parallelism is broken here. There's this twist in what the writer says, and he says then that what Christ now is awaiting is not his day of judgment, but this second appearing of his. And this second appearing then, it's not to deal with sin again. Our writer is clear on that, because he can't die again, and repetition is unnecessary anyway. But he says this second appearing is to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. And so you see what he's saying then. He's saying that not only is a second coming, it not only is a repetition of Christ's sacrifice unnecessary, because he's put away sin, not only is it unthinkable because he can't die a second time, but compared to what is actually going to happen, it's undesirable. Who wants Christ to come again and have to suffer on a cross again, when in fact he's going to come again in this more glorious way, and he's going to save his people finally, and he's going to gather up those who are waiting for him and bring about for them the consummation of all they've been anticipating. What does he mean, save those who are waiting for him? Haven't we been saved? He's put away our sin. Well, yes, as we said, our guilt has gone. If you're a believer this morning, your guilt has been utterly dismantled, but have you been saved entirely from sin? Have you sinned this past week? Yes. So there's still sin in your life. You haven't been saved fully from the presence of sin, the existence of sin in your life. Are you ever ill? Are you one day going to die? Yes. So you haven't been saved from the effects of sin in your body. And what our writer is saying then is that one day, just as surely as we have now been saved from sin in our consciences, we will be saved from sin in our very behavior and in our very bodies even. And so the challenge then for us all who are believers this morning is, are we in the category of those who are eagerly waiting for him? We talk about being saved, don't we, sometimes? I was saved such and such a time. And that's legitimate language. But are you equally passionate about the fact you're going to be saved in the future? Is that as much on your radar as the fact that, yes, at one point God saved you in the sense he called you and he converted you and he made you a Christian? Are you equally passionate that one day he's going to save you in this fuller sense? Is that on your radar this morning? We often say that the great fault line between human beings that runs down the middle of the human race, it's the fault line between those who are saved and those who are not saved. In a sense, you could redefine that and say the great fault line is between those who are looking forward to salvation and those who are not looking forward to salvation. Are you in that former camp this morning? If you're not trusting in Christ, you can't be looking forward to this salvation. Come to him this morning. Take hold of him as your Saviour. But if you have done that, then clear away the rubble that's distracting you from eagerly awaiting Jesus' return and looking forward to him appearing on the horizon, changing our bodies, changing the physical world itself, bringing into being what our writer has earlier on described as the world to come, when all things will be put in subjection to man in Christ. What a prospect. Eagerly await it. Amen.